From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Simon Smart.
In the 2nd century, a Greek writer called Celsus sneered at Christianity as a religion of women, children and slaves. To him, that was reason enough not to take it seriously.
It was radical. It was an enormous change. It was often ridiculed by pagan writers. But of course, it wasn't a religion of women and slaves. It soon was a religion of emperors.
This is Professor Rodney Stark from Baylor University in the US. He's a sociologist who's famous for his work on religion and especially for his book on how the obscure, marginal Jesus movement became the dominant religious force in the Western world in a few centuries. And he's thought quite a bit about this link between women and religion.
All religious movements attract women more than men. It's a subject I've tried to write on. We don't really understand why it is that women are more apt to convert, although my student Alan Miller had a brilliant insight in saying we should stop asking why women are more apt to be religious and ask why men are more apt to be irreligious. And he suggested that why are men more apt to be criminal? That it's kind of the same thing. It's risk-taking. It's short-sighted behavior. And that men are more prone to it. It may even be biological for all we know, but it certainly is universal.
I rather like this idea. I mean, today we wouldn't speak the way that Celsus does, as though women are more gullible or something, and so them supporting a religion discredits it. But you do still sometimes hear this idea that women being more religious than men on the whole is something as though it's a bit abnormal, maybe irrational. Stark turns that on its head and says, maybe the strange thing isn't women being more religious, maybe actually it's men being less religious.
Yes, and Stark suggests that there were some very rational reasons by anyone's standards why so many women did choose to become Christians in those first couple of centuries.
Every religious movement I've ever seen any data on was disproportionately female, and that was certainly true of the early church. Not that they didn't, of course, convert large numbers of men, because obviously they did. But, you know, to put it kind of frankly, Christianity was a goodbye.
We're going to hear more from Professor Stark about why Christianity was such a goodbye in just a moment, as we explore the fraught relationship the church has had with women and the role Christianity has played both in helping women flourish and in oppressing them.
And we'll hear from other experts on this topic as well, Sarah Coakley, Judith Liu, and Beverly Gaventa. These are just some of the scholars we interviewed for CPX's forthcoming documentary, For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined. But let's start with this claim that Stark makes that might sound surprising to some, that Christianity, especially in its earliest stages, was an attractive religion for the poor and disadvantaged. He says that the church basically offered care and community, social services we might call them today, in a world where social services didn't exist yet, and it had particular benefits for women.
In some ways, it's surprising that every woman in the Roman Empire didn't become a Christian overnight because the advantages were so great. Roman girls typically got married at 12 or 13 to men who were in the 30s and 40s. Christian girls tended to get married at 18. And to have some say in who they married, and to not easily be divorced, with the expectation that their husbands would be faithful, and perhaps, and this is a messy topic, no abortion. Can you imagine what abortion was like in a world that didn't know about germs, had no anesthesia? It was an incredibly brutal and very often fatal practice. And you say, well, then why did women do it? Because they had no choice, because men decided whether or not they would abort. The same was true with the killing of infants. Husbands would say, well, if it's a boy, keep it. If it's a girl, lay it out on along the road and be done with it. It was a brutal world, and Christianity provided a very secure haven of humanity for people, and it's not really surprising that that was attractive.
So there's a sense that Christian communities offered an escape for some women from the brutality of their lives and a fuller vision of human flourishing for women alongside men. Professor Judith Liu from Cambridge University, she's also one of the university's gender equality champions, explains.
I think it's clear from Paul's letters, but also from later sources, that some women found that they were able to explore their own autonomy, if I can use that word, within the Christian message. This might not seem terribly attractive, but we get stories of women martyrs, which implies that women were recognized as actually standing up for their faith in their own person and being able to be just as brave and confident about it as their male counterparts. And in some ways that's quite striking, because the normal model in ancient society is that bravery is a masculine virtue. Women are a little bit more unstable.
Actually, this radical equality, which includes being killed for their beliefs, was built into the teachings of the early church.
Paul's teaching, neither male nor female, as well as neither slave nor free, didn't get rid of those social distinctions. We continue to have slaves as well as free people. But it did imply that the message was equally open to all parts of society. And women may well have found that something attractive.
However, Christianity is much more likely to be criticized today for being against women, for holding them back, than for its radical vision of gender equality.
In its inception, Christianity set before women a true possibility of complete transformation on equal terms alongside men. But at the same time, it very quickly accommodated itself into existing religious and cultural mores. And you could say that that tension has been played out since then.
That was Professor Sarah Coakley. She's from Cambridge as well, and she's written extensively on gender theory and the philosophy of religion.
Certainly, one can think of plenty of examples of this. Tertullian saying of Eve, "You are the devil's gateway." And one could multiply examples of women not only being unconsciously or consciously subordinated in Christian culture, but also actually first pedestalized and then demonized as dangerous seductresses.
As in many things, Christianity doesn't necessarily have a good story to tell over the centuries in its treatment of women, as in other things.
This is Judith Liu again.
And we do get emerging within some early Christian rhetoric the idea that women represent danger and they represent instability. Now, partly that has got roots in early Jewish and Greco-Roman thought, where women were associated with instability, with hysteria, irrationality, the passions. Partly it goes back to ideas we already find in scripture, where women are seen as seductive and therefore as a sort of image of the seduction that might draw a man away from his faithfulness. And some of that then gets projected onto women, along with a sense that therefore one needs to control women because it's a way of controlling their sexuality and keeping men safe. You begin to get a growing sense that those who hold office within the church can only be men, and that there's a sort of parallel between being able to control one's family and being able to sufficiently control the church, and women are part of that. And then one also gets a tradition that develops of asceticism, of the desire to control the passions of the body, to uphold not just chastity, but abstinence. And women become, to some extent, I was going to say both the victims, but also benefit from that. Because we get many stories after a while of women actually exercising their independence, their autonomy, by rejecting conventional marriage.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. If you've just joined us, we're hearing from leading biblical scholars about Christianity's record when it comes to women. What we've heard so far is that throughout the history of Christianity, this has been a really mixed bag. There's a sense that women's rights and gender equality rise out of the early days of Christianity, but this quickly takes a turn towards oppression and even demonization of women. An important question for evaluating whether Christianity itself is good for women or can be good for them is to look at Jesus himself.
First and foremost, the teaching of Jesus set before women the possibility of, I think, truly equal treatment. It's true that Jesus did not choose women to be amongst his 12 disciples. But nonetheless, he had women followers who were with him throughout his teaching career. By all accounts, were the ones who didn't abandon him when his male disciples fled, and played an extraordinarily important role, especially Mary Magdalene, in the promulgation of the resurrection.
And we do see glimpses of this, of the opportunities for women to flourish from the early church until today. Professor Beverly Gaventa, a New Testament scholar from Baylor University, says there are plenty of examples in the Bible of women in leadership roles within Christian communities.
What those were exactly is a little hard to tell, but I think our best evidence about women's activity in the earliest communities, it comes in Paul's letter to the Romans. We have Prisca or Priscilla referred to there, who hosts a church in her home. Now, to us, that sounds like, you know, hospitality, and we denigrate it. But if that's where the church met, then that makes you the leader, because it's in your place. You're the one who is the convener. But he goes on there to greet a number of people. He greets, I think it's 7 out of 22 of the people he greets are women. And he says things about how they have labored in the Lord. He uses the very same Greek words for them that he does of himself. He even refers to a woman by the name of Junia, who is an apostle. That comes as a shock to a lot of us, in part because our translations have covered it up. But for the first 1,000 years of the church's life, people who talked about that passage called her an apostle. So it seems clear that women were active, that they did a number of things, that they weren't just making the coffee and cleaning up after the meetings.
And even throughout some of the more restrictive periods of Christian history, faith offered channels for women to subvert the roles that were assigned to them. It wasn't easy, but within monasteries, for example, if women chose the life of a nun, they had opportunities for learning and for exercising significant power, actually, that weren't available to women pretty much anywhere else in the world at the time. Coakley says,
women had the opportunity to pursue a celibate, monastic role that allowed them to escape from the subordinations which were assumed to be normative within the marriage role for them in the culture. And it's really in this area that an enormous amount of research of a creative sort has been going on in recent decades, showing that when women lived an ascetic life, they not only could operate quite autonomously in certain circumstances, but also their very understandings of themselves in gender terms were freed up from the presumptions that femininity involved subordination. In fact, it gave to them an extraordinarily fluid understanding of what they were capable of achieving, thinking, and what leadership roles they might take. For instance, Macrina, the famous older sister of Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nyssa, was someone that was admired by her brothers above and beyond how they admired themselves in their intellectual and episcopal roles. And she herself was perceived as, in a strange sense, beyond gender in worldly terms. If you look at the history of contemplation and of ascetic practices in relation to contemplation, you will find that some of the most powerful, courageous women and other contemplatives in the tradition, great reformers such as the Carmelites, Teresa of Avila was no pushover, and she is a particular heroine of mine, who precisely through a life of contemplation, precisely through a life of handing over at the deepest level of the self to the life of God, have the capacity to resist injustice, oppression, both from their own order, from the church, and from the world at large. One has to acknowledge, it seems to me, that there is a strand here in Christianity which has the capacity to correct that in Christianity, which has taken the part of the oppressor.
Christianity certainly has a checkered past then when it comes to the treatment of women, and we're really only scratching the surface here. Actually, though, the radical Christian idea from its earliest days of equality between the sexes, that's something we can be glad of, has influenced our society in all sorts of ways. The suffragettes, for example, very many of whom were motivated by Christian faith, emphasized the value of women as human beings on a level with men.
And while we think about some of the failures of Christians in this area, it's probably worth acknowledging that this is something that we're all still struggling with and figuring out today.
It may well be that one of the reasons Christianity is attractive early on to so many women is precisely the value placed on women. Whether the church has always acted on that, I think, is a little harder, or acted out its principles is a little harder to determine, just as it's hard to determine now whether we enact all the things that we say we stand for.
I think we're now moving into a phase where, when we look at the heritage of the Christian tradition, this question of how women flourish in our society has to be set alongside how men and children and old people flourish, with a sort of holistic picture. And boy, are we very far from understanding yet how we are to achieve this in society at large.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. We hope this episode on women and Christianity gave you a bit to think about.
This was the third part of a four-part series featuring interviews from our documentary coming out next year. It's going to be called For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined. To catch up on part one, The Evolution of the West, and part two, The Crusades, those are available on our website, publicchristianity.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just type CPX in the search box to find us. Next week, we wrap up the series with a look at slavery and the value of human life. Join us then.